The Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that a whopping $7.3 billion of subsidies are going to something known as the Federal Home Loan Banking System. This is a little known part of the financial system. At least it's not something that I knew about before starting to research this show. And with a budget like $7.3 billion, you would think that this should be having a huge impact on affordability and the housing market as a whole. But today we're going to dig into whether that's actually happening or not. Hey, everyone, and welcome to On the Market. I'm your host, Dave Meyer. And today we have an excellent guest joining us today. Her name is Sharon Cornelison, who is the Director of Housing for the Consumer Federation of America. And with Sharon today, we're going to talk about the history of these subsidies that are going to the federal home loan banks and what's going on with them today. And we'll talk about how some proposed reforms that are going through Washington, D.C. right now could impact affordable housing and housing inventory going forward. All right, let's bring on Sharon. Sharon, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
To start off, tell us a little bit about what it means to be the Director of Housing for the Consumer Federation of America.
Yeah, so the Consumer Federation of America is a national, nonpartisan pro-consumer organization that leads in research and advocacy on pro-consumer issues. So as a Director of Housing, I'm responsible for all our positions on housing and housing policy. And I do both research and advocacy on housing.
And how did you come into this role and begin specializing in housing?
Yeah, it's kind of a funny story, I guess. So I first started to be interested in housing about a decade ago. I was doing my PhD in sociology, and I moved to Detroit to try to better understand the city and what people were going through living in an extremely depopulated neighborhood. So I moved to one of the most depopulated urban neighborhoods of the United States. And while I was there, homes were selling from $500. A lot of homes were vacant. Every other house in the neighborhood where I lived was vacant. So I actually ended up buying a house myself there in Detroit for $7,000. So may be of interest to some of your listeners. So I had to, of course, buy it cash in this neighborhood. All the normal institutions that normally support housing markets did not exist anymore, did not function anymore. So there were no mortgages, pretty much no real estate agents. A lot of people did not have home insurance. So it was really challenging for a lot of Detroiters in particular to try to hold on to their home. A lot of people were losing their homes, both due to tax foreclosures, they were falling behind on their tax bills, and also because of home repairs that were kind of spiraling out of control. If you have no home equity and no insurance, it's very expensive to maintain it, right? So I became really interested in housing, living there and seeing Detroiters go through tax foreclosure and trying to organize to keep people in their homes. And I think if you live in a place where the housing market basically has collapsed, you understand how important it is really for housing stability, for kids growing up in a stable home, but also for a neighborhood to kind of keep a community together. Housing is really important for that as well. So that's kind of how I got into the field.
That's an incredible story. I would imagine that would be very transformative in terms of your life and your career. Before we jump into some of your research, what year was that that you moved there and bought the house?
Yeah, I moved there in 2015 and I bought the house in 2016.
Okay, so even, almost a decade after the collapse, that was still the situation.
Yeah, it was sort of the secondary collapse. Detroit went through the foreclosure crisis, bank foreclosures first, and then, about 7-8 years later, like especially 2015, 2016, it went through a second crisis, the tax foreclosure crisis, as home prices remained so low and people could not keep up on their tax bills.
Well, let's move on to your work at the Consumer Federation of America. I understand that you do a lot of work with housing subsidies. Can you just give us an overview of what subsidies are like in the United States and just a general landscape?
Yeah, well, there's a. I think the subsidies that get a lot of attention, maybe subsidies paid to individuals. For example, you have Section 8 housing vouchers for people that are very low income and cannot afford to pay rents otherwise. But you have also subsidies, housing subsidies that go to really large institutions that, you know, often get less attention. I think in the media, perhaps because it's less visible, they're not that open about the subsidies that they receive. And it's perhaps more technical. People kind of check out as soon as we start talking about GSEs and housing finance reform, Federal Home Loan Bank. So these subsidies are less visible, I guess.
That's true. But I think you'll find a ready and willing audience here on the market. Our audience really likes learning about the intricacies of the housing market and how it all works. So, you know, you mentioned there's Section 8, there's also the GSEs. Like, do you have a number for the total amount of subsidies that annually that are distributed for housing?
Yeah, and this is not my number. This is a number from the Congressional Budget Office. They published a report very recently to calculate how much Federal Home Loan Banks, this GSE, receive every year. And they pegged that number at $7.3 billion in 2024. So that's quite a number right there.
Okay, $7.3 billion. And that's made up of both Section 8 housing and some of the more bank side, or is that just Section 8?
No, that's just subsidy that just goes to the Federal Home Loan Banks.
Oh, okay, I see.
This is a number that they receive. Yeah.
Okay, and this is taxpayer dollars that I assume are attributed by Congress?
No, they are not. They're not appropriated by Congress. The subsidy kind of goes through a back door. It doesn't show up in a budget for Congress, but it's a subsidy nonetheless.
How does that work?
How does that work? So they are a government-sponsored enterprise, a GSE, and it means that they receive unique tax and regulatory benefits. They have a sort of unique status granted to them by Congress in exchange for providing unmet credit needs and public benefits, right? So they're receiving the status in order to meet an unmet credit need. So this includes, for example, that there's an implied federal guarantee on all the debt that they take out. So if you are an investor, you know, you pick between different investment options. And in the case of a GSE, you know that if this Federal Home Loan Bank will fail, the government will step in to kind of rescue it, basically. So it lowers the risk profile. So therefore, you know, the debt, the government is indirectly providing a subsidy on Federal Home Loan Bank's debt in that way. They also have what's called a super lien on their debt. So that means if one of the banks that they're lending money to, for example, a regional bank that they're lending money to, fails, the Federal Home Loan Banks have first dibs, basically, on assets to kind of get their money back, even before the FDIC, so even before taxpayers, they get first dibs.
Wow.
So these are all features that make them more attractive for investors and that create this big discount that they get on their debt. So the government is basically giving them all these special benefits and statuses and tax-free status. And in total, that special status is worth $7.3 billion every year.
Wow. Okay. So yeah. I'm going to try and summarize this to make sure I fully understand what's going on. There are select banks. The acronym GSE applies to them. That stands for government-subsidized entities, is that right?
Government-sponsored enterprises.
Government-sponsored enterprises. Okay, so there are certain banks, and we'll get into which ones they are in just a minute. Let's go step by step here.
Yeah, so there are 11 Federal Home Loan Banks. So they're regional banks, kind of like the Federal Reserve System, right? So they are I call them bank for banks. So they're not like Bank of America or Chase themselves. No, this is an overarching bank for banks, basically. So banks can get cheap loans, a cheap source of liquidity from the Federal Home Loan Banks, right? So the role of Federal Home Loan Banks is to, they get a discount on their own debt because of their GSE status, and then they pass on that discount to their members, which are banks, credit unions, insurance companies, all the like. So what they do is to basically give banks a cheap source of money, a cheap source of liquidity. And historically, that money has been used to help banks provide mortgages. But today, members are doing anything with that money. Many banks, as you know, like are not even in the business of lending mortgages anymore. So they can use money for any purpose that they see fit.
Wow.
So it could be, you know, just for acute liquidity needs in the very moment. You know, Silicon Valley Bank, you know, was lending a lot of money right before it failed. Or if you are an insurance company, you could say, hey, that's great. That's cheap money. Let's borrow, you know, a bunch of cheap money and then I'll invest it elsewhere. And then I can keep the difference, right? I can make money that way.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good deal for those banks, just or an insurance company, just being able to get cheap debt and basically do arbitrage and lend it out for a higher interest rate somewhere else.
Yes.
Or invest it wherever they want.
Yeah, exactly.
So you said these are banks of banks. Have we heard of any of these banks, or would normal people recognize the names of them?
Well, I mean, their names are like the Federal Home Loan Bank of Atlanta, the Federal Home Loan Bank of Pittsburgh,
San
Francisco. Okay. So that's their names. I think everyday Americans have not heard of them because they don't directly interact with you or me as consumers, right? They are the bank for banks. So they interact directly with big companies, not with everyday people.
Okay, got it. Okay, we have to take a quick break, but stay with us. More on housing subsidies right after this.
Interest rates are sky high in 2023, and buying a rental property means you could get stuck with an 8, 9, or 10% mortgage rate. But what about a 2.99% rate with Rent to Retirement? Rent to Retirement has 2.99% seller financing available on turnkey properties. You heard that right. That's a seller financed 2.99% interest rate with an average cash flow of over $900 per month. Plus, they've got options where you can put as little as 5% down with no PMI. As the nation's leading turnkey investment company, Rent to Retirement helps investors build headache-free, high cash flow rental portfolios. And since their properties are fully turnkey, newly built or renovated, leased and managed, anyone can invest, even those who aren't into landlording. So what are you waiting for? This 2.99% rate deal won't last long. To learn more, visit renttoretirement.com. That's renttoretirement.com. Or text REI to 33777. Again, text REI to 33777.
Buy low, sell high. Very easy to say, but not always so easy to do. For example, high interest rates are hurting the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices in a lot of markets are falling, even for many of the best assets. So it's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/pockets. Fundrise.com/pockets. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
The dream of owning a vacation home can be daunting, from finding the best guests, to the maintenance, to organizing the cleaners after every guest day. With Vacasa, they make that dream into a reality. As a full-service vacation home management company with vacation homes in key destinations across the U.S., they know a thing about how to make owning a vacation home easy and profitable. On top of proactive property maintenance visits by professional local teams, a hospitality-driven booking platform, and around-the-clock support, Vacasa earns homeowners an average of 20% more revenue from their vacation homes. Vacasa is always thinking of ways to simplify the vacation home owning experience by putting your home to work for you. If you're looking to make more from your vacation home, work with the reliable property manager, and finally have peace of mind, partner with Vacasa at vacasa.com/biggerpockets. That's vacasa.com/biggerpockets.
Welcome back to On the Market. Let's pick back up with Sharon Cornelison and housing subsidies. And so I assume that this policy and system was put in place in an effort to make homeownership more affordable?
Yeah. So the system was founded in 1932. This was during what I call the greatest housing crisis of the last century, right? So this was during the Great Depression. There's really a struggle to, you know, for people to own houses or to buy homes at all with mortgages. Mortgages are very expensive. Mortgage money wasn't readily available. At the time, if you are, you know, in the 30s, if you are a bank, you rely on deposits as your source of liquidity. And then depending on how many deposits you have, you can originate mortgages based on those deposits. So yeah, at the time they were like, well, wouldn't it be great if there was a more reliable source of liquidity for mortgages? So Congress chartered the Federal Home Loan Bank system at the time so that they could make more liquidity available for mortgages. So mortgages would be more widely available and they would be cheaper. That was sort of the idea in the 1930s.
And did it work back then, at least?
I mean, there were a lot of things that were innovated in the 30s, right? The Federal Housing Administration was also kind of founded around that time. So they were in a big crisis. So crisis often is a good time for innovation and new opportunities. So I think at the time it did work. It was a good source for mortgage lending. The members at the time were engaged in mortgage lending, and this was a good way for them to get more liquidity.
Okay. And now this is going to be a bit of a subjective question, but would you say it's working today?
Well, clearly, I believe it is not. your listeners will also understand the mortgage market has really changed over the last 90 years, right? So first of all, a lot of the people or a lot of the institutions that used to be engaged in mortgage lending are not anymore. A lot of the mortgage lending today is actually done by independent mortgage banks, such as Rocket Mortgage or, you know, those sort of online mortgage banks. And they are not members of Federal Home Loan Banks at all, right? So a lot of the mortgage lending has shifted and a lot of traditional banks are no longer in the business anymore. And then the second big change that has happened is that since the 1980s, we saw the rise of securitization. So right now, if you're a bank and you originate a mortgage, you turn around and then you sell that mortgage to Fannie or Freddie, most likely, right? So you're not keeping it on your books. So the capital that you need to originate a mortgage is very different from what it was in the 30s when there wasn't that secondary market yet.
Well, I was a little bit joking when I asked if you liked it, because for our audience, Sharon is the chair of the Coalition for Federal Home Loan Bank Reform. So obviously you're looking to change this program. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the coalition?
Yeah, so this coalition started, we were sort of trying to find individuals and groups that were united around the idea that the status quo, you know, for Federal Home Loan Banks is not acceptable. So right now we have 10 national organizations that include civil rights organizations, housing, as well as a labor union as well. And together they represent thousands of smaller organizations across the country and well over 1 million local members. We also have an advisory board with a lot of GSE and financial regulation and banking experts on it. So the advisory board has been very helpful in sort of, you know, giving us ideas for reform and just answering questions where needed, because some of these things can get pretty complex pretty quickly.
Okay. So when you look at the state of the subsidies today, is the problem that the money's just not going where it's intended to, or is it being used inefficiently? You already mentioned that, you know, banks can sort of take the money and lend it out to it, not as mortgages. Is that the primary problem, or what's sort of the big issue?
Yeah. So if you are a GSE, a government-sponsored enterprise, there's always a sort of a tension, right? So GSEs, they were founded with a public mission. So there are some unmet credit needs, you know, that is not served by the private market, right? So that's why you need a GSE to begin with. Otherwise, the private market could take care of it. So you start a GSE with a public mission, but then it's also kind of private at the same time. It's a hybrid, right? So it's also driven by maximizing profits. So over time, the profit motive has sort of eclipsed the the public mission, right? So they're really driven by just pursuing more volume and, you know, more profits, and not by thinking carefully about, well, how can we make the biggest impact on housing? So I think that's sort of an inherent tension that exists for Federal Home Loan Banks.
And I guess, in your opinion, at least, it seems that there wasn't enough regulation put in place or specificity to the arrangement here that is allowing the GSEs to pursue profit over the public benefit that it's intended for?
Yeah, I think, I mean, as I said, the mortgage market has sort of shifted over time, right? So I think we've sort of lost track of this GSE as the market shifted. And they, of course, went about their business because they're motivated. I understand that they're motivated by their own, bottom line. That is important for them to continue to exist in some ways, right? So the mortgage market evolved. And yeah, I think, you know, they need more tight regulation to kind of make sure that they're fulfilling that mission for which they were founded, and that we are getting the right public benefits from those subsidies, right? Like, why are we giving subsidies? Why are we giving the GSE the special status and tax benefits, and subsidies if we're not getting the equivalent in return? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, if they are not doing that, perhaps they shouldn't exist at all, right? Like, we can't just be handing out subsidies and not getting, getting public benefits in return.
Right. Yeah. There needs to be some mutual benefit. Yeah. Right? Like, you know, they can't just get the benefit of subsidies without providing the public benefit. But as you said, it sounds like it just started so long ago and perhaps hasn't evolved as quickly as it needs to in order to keep up with the current financial system. So, Sharon, what are some of the regulations that you think should go into place, or what needs to change in your mind?
Yeah, I think there's two kind of big items that have to change. So the first one is around mission and making sure that we are really clear about what the mission is of the Federal Home Loan Bank and say, well, they are, you know, there to provide liquidity for housing, affordable housing, you know, and community development. And if that's so, then everything else should flow from that mission. So I think clarifying the mission is sort of the first step. And the second one is membership. It's like, who should be, if that's the mission, and if the point is to really provide, you know, more liquidity to mortgages and to help more affordable housing development, then who should be a member? Does it make sense that insurance companies are members of Federal Home Loan Banks when they're not doing anything in housing anymore, or they're not originating a single mortgage? Like, why are they there? That doesn't really make sense. Really making sure that the members that are part of the Federal Home Loan Bank system, you know, use it to you know, advance affordable housing goals. So I think small bank, community banks, should reap the full benefits of Federal Home Loan Bank membership. What's called community development financial institutions, which are CDFIs, really make sure that they can get full access to Federal Home Loan Bank advances and use that money to build more housing. You know, that's sort of what we like to see.
Okay, it is time for our last quick break. But when we come back, we'll get Sharon's take on how federal home loan bank reform could impact the affordability crisis in the U.S. Stay tuned.
Remember when you had to pay to get a lead's phone number? It was like the dark ages, until Deal Machine made skip tracing a thing of the past. Now, with your Deal Machine plan, you'll get unlimited access to phone numbers and contact information for no extra cost. That's right, get high quality, reliable information trusted by leading financial institutions, all fully compliant with the federal Do Not Call list. Explore over 150 data points, including age, gender, marital status, occupation, and a ton more. Trust me, this is the data you need for off-market deals. With new filters, people flags, and color-coded phone numbers, lead management just got a ton easier. Ready to step up your investing game? Sign up for a Deal Machine plan today and gain immediate access to this unlimited treasure trove of contact information and phone numbers. Just head to dealmachine.com/BP. Transform your lead generation and deal-making strategies with Deal Machine. Sign up today and start exploring the unlimited possibilities at dealmachine.com/BP.
This show is sponsored by Airbnb. Did you know that a long time ago, before I ever started my real estate business, I turned one of my first primary residences into an Airbnb, and that's the extra income that I needed from Airbnb that gave me the confidence to go out and work for myself and eventually quit my 9-to-5 job. And now I have dozens of Airbnbs all over the country. I've even partnered up with the old David Green on a recent property in Scottsdale to take our portfolio to the next level. And of course, we host it on Airbnb. But you don't need to be a full-time real estate investor to start on Airbnb. As a matter of fact, I was self-managing 10 properties while working my 9-to-5 job, so I know anybody can do it. Think about it this way. You're looking for extra income and going on a vacation. Wouldn't it be great to rent out your space and let your property pay for itself while you're gone? I did this one time. I pitched my wife and my roommate, because we were house hacking, on the idea of renting out our home, and it paid for all of our expenses on a trip to Mexico City. So go and give it a try. It might just change your life, just like it did mine. And I really do mean that. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you can make sure your ride stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED lights, exhaust kits, turbochargers, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com. Top real estate investors love to talk about how they save so much on taxes. But how are they able to build rental property empires while skirting Uncle Sam? 1031 exchanges. 1031 exchanges allow you to defer capital gains taxes while you sell an investment property, exchanging your old property for a bigger, better one and avoiding the tax man while you do it. And that's where First American Exchange Company comes in. They're the leaders in 1031 exchanges. Whether you're a seasoned investor or just starting, First American Exchange can help you with simple rental property exchanges, complex commercial real estate investments, reverse exchanges, and more. Don't let your taxes eat into your profits. Visit First American Exchange Company at firstexchange.com or call them at 800-556-2520. That's firstexchange.com or 800-556-2520. Keep your money in your pocket and propel your portfolio further at firstexchange.com. First American Exchange Company does not provide tax or legal advice. Consult your financial, real estate, tax, or legal advisor about your circumstances. First American Exchange Company. Safe, smart, secure.
Welcome back, everyone. Let's jump back in. And how is the reaction to these proposals? I know you work for a bipartisan foundation. You know, is this being received well by both parties in Congress and the banks themselves?
So yeah, we're seeing greater and greater reception of this in the administration and in Congress. So Joe Biden, in his State of the Union sort of housing proposal, he flagged the need for Federal Home Loan Bank as one of the priorities of the administration in housing moving forward, specifically making sure that they're devoting more money to affordable housing programs every year. Right now, they're only required to devote 10% of their income to affordable housing programs, but the administration wants that to be at least 20%, sort of a first step, right, to make them more aligned. We see more and more support in Congress as well. Senator Cortez Masto has been a big supporter of this. She's in Senate Banking as well. And then Senator Elizabeth Warren kind of recently came out to really support the need for reform. But ultimately, I think it's a bipartisan issue. I mean, I know, for example, Cato Institute has written as well about the absurdity of a system as it currently exists. Right. So we see both from progressive voices and more conservative voices the need to really reform the system. So I'm hoping that moving forward, there will be more and more people signing on to a bill and we can sort of turn this into a bipartisan housing bill.
And should this pass one day, what would be the impact on the housing market?
Yeah. So just to give you an example, last year in 2023, it was actually the most profitable year for the Federal Home Loan Banks ever, I think, in history. So based on that profit, they will be required to spend $752 million in affordable housing programs next year, right? So that 10% of their income they're required right now to spend on affordable housing programs. If our proposal passes and they, instead of 10%, have to spend 30% on affordable housing programs every year, that would mean an additional $1.5 billion in investments going towards housing. That includes, they often spend these affordable housing dollars on gap financing for affordable housing developments, like LIHTC developments, as well as on down payment assistance, right? So that an additional $1.5 billion could really do a lot more in sort of both addressing our issue of housing supply and addressing sort of longstanding issues of equity and who has access to home buying in this market.
Got it. Okay. Makes a lot of sense. For our audience of investors, if they are interested in creating affordable housing or being one of those developers, is there a way for them to get involved?
I think that they should look at the website of Federal Home Loan Banks and see in what region they fall, and sort of then from there, go look basically for that gap financing for affordable housing developments. I must say that from what I've heard from people, from developers, it is notoriously hard to get this type of money. And they say it's often the last money in, the first money out, because it's so complicated to qualify for it. So that's another thing that we think should change. Like it should be more accessible. It should be used, you know, more logically. It shouldn't be that complicated to qualify for this kind of financing on top of LIHTC or other credits. You know, you nod, you're saying it's a common problem.
Yeah, it just it does seem. You know, we talk to a lot of developers on this show, a lot of people who represent government agencies or policy advocates like yourself, and it is just a common refrain we hear is, although there is intent to create affordable housing or public-private partnerships, that they're often quite complicated.
Yeah.
Well, Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today and educating us on this topic. I did not understand this at all before our conversation, and thank you for educating me and our audience. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much. I was glad I could. I know it's complicated, so happy to be a resource anytime, Dave.
And for anyone who wants to learn more about Sharon or her work at the Consumer Federation of America, we'll put all of her contact information in the show notes below. On the Market was created by me, Dave Meyer, and Kaylin Bennett. The show is produced by Kaylin Bennett with editing by Exodus Media. Copywriting is by Calico Content, and we want to extend a big thank you to everyone at Bigger Pockets for making this show possible. The housing market is changing, and finding your way right now can be a bit tricky. There are rate shifts, there are confusing headlines, but at the end of the day, your goal hasn't changed. You probably still want financial freedom as much as ever. Well, the good thing is that experienced investors know it's not about trying to time the market. It's about the amount of time you have in the market. And if you're ready to get into real estate investing game, you can still do that. Or you can take your game to the next level by finding an investor-friendly agent. With Bigger Pockets Agent Finder, you can find the right agent in just a few minutes. You head over to biggerpockets.com/deals, enter in some details about what you want, where you want to buy, and boom, you instantly get matched with an investor-friendly agent who fits the bill. These local market experts can help you navigate the neighborhoods, analyze the numbers, and take action with confidence once and for all. This free resource is only available at biggerpockets.com/deals. Get an agent, get the deal, and get closer to financial freedom at biggerpockets.com/deals. That's biggerpockets.com/deals to find your investor-friendly agent today.
The content of this podcast is for informational purposes only. Past performance is not indicative of future results, and all hosts and participant opinions are their own. Investments in any asset, real estate included, involves risk. Use your best judgment and consult with qualified advisors before investing. Only risk capital you can afford to lose. Bigger Pockets LLC disclaims all liability for direct, indirect, consequential, or other damages arising from reliance upon information presented in this podcast.